From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 92 of Little Brother for the 9th of July, 2022. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. So, let's get started. Well, this didn't take long. A woman in Mississippi is facing charges for an illegal abortion. Part of the evidence against her is that her phone's search history revealed her attempt to find a way to buy misoprostol. Meanwhile, in Indiana, another woman is facing similar charges based on her texting history. I've said it before, you're carrying a little snitch in your pocket, and people need to learn not to trust their phones and the apps that they run. But we can trust our end-to-end cryptographic chat apps, right? Well, while I do still generally recommend Signal Private Messenger because the source is open and it can be examined for issues, secure delivery of a message doesn't guarantee that the message is secure once it's delivered. Last week, I mentioned how the EU might require users' devices to scan end-to-end encryption traffic for child porn and other abominations. This week, the UK, who I'm not so sure but I thought were not interested in being part of the EU, have rumbled that they may follow suit. A recent amendment was passed that would require end-to-end encrypted app producers to make their best endeavors to scan content. The Office of Communications, Ofcom, that's the UK's counterpart to the FCC, would be granted the ability to fine app producers £18 million, or 10% of their annual revenue, whichever is higher, for non-compliance. A recently passed law here in New York State would require that would-be gun owners provide the government with a list of social media accounts and to allow them to access the last 3 years of content. It does not require that law enforcement be able to log into the accounts, just that they be able to read them and find them. The intent is to use the postings and the comments of a prospective gun owner to assess the person's fitness to be a gun owner. Meanwhile, in California, the breach of gun ownership data that I reported last week as the Pwn of the Week turns out to have actually been much more significant than previously thought. It was originally believed that the data breach had covered only recipients of concealed carry permits. In fact, it seems to have also covered everyone who has ever applied for such a permit. This is kind of problematic because gun ownership or lack of it should be kept out of the public view as a matter of basic OPSEC. Whether a person is armed or not should be a private matter. As those of us interested in cybersecurity generally know, physical access is the holy grail of an attacker. If an attacker can gain physical access to a computer system, the game is over and they won. A penetration tester who goes by CyberGibbons wrote up an amusing way that he'd found to gain access to one of his client's systems. The building, it seems, had washrooms back to back. One pair in the insecure area, one pair in the secure area. The insecure and the secure men's washroom were connected by a service corridor, and that service corridor was not locked, giving our intrepid pentester the ability to walk into the washroom on one side, enter the service corridor, exit on the other end in the secure area, and simply walk on out into the data center. As the service corridor backed up to all of the toilets, he dubbed it the piss corridor. Lastly, demonstrating that no intrusion is too big to get bigger, L3 Harris, the maker of the Stingray MZ Catcher, a device used to snoop on cell phone traffic, is in talks to purchase Israeli security firm NSO Group, which I've mentioned many times on this podcast, maker of numerous tools for prying data out of smartphones. I can only imagine what evil such a union will beget. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. We're kicking off with the fail of the week this time, because it's important. This week's fail is Rogers Communications, Inc. Rogers Communications is a large Canadian conglomerate headquartered in Toronto, with its core business being internet, cellular, cable, and landline telephone services. Around 4:30 Eastern Time on Friday morning, it went down. All of it. No internet, no TV, no phone, no landline or cellular. Down. The scene repeating itself in cities across Canada was of groups of Rogers customers crowding into and around coffee shops, libraries, and other buildings with public Wi-Fi who were not using Rogers for their service in order to get connected. I can only imagine what the slowness of the connections must have been. It had to be epic. All across Canada, shops were putting out signs to let the customers know that the payment card machines were down and that they were only taking cash because they got their service from Rogers. Other businesses had won the lottery by picking a different provider. Some ATMs were up and running, others not so much. Oh, it gets worse. Police and fire departments also had communications problems, and 911 calls were not working as they should, if at all. As the outage dragged on into the night, The Weeknd was supposed to be performing at Rogers Centre in Toronto. Well, they couldn't operate the venue without working telecoms. And since Rogers owns the naming rights to the venue, I think it's probably a safe and easy guess that the telecoms on site were not provided by TELUS or Bell Canada. Pity. They might have actually been online. The gathered crowds outside of Rogers Centre were obviously disappointed to find out that they were not going to be able to hear Blinding Lights performed live. Well, I would be too. I mean, that song is a bop. One Twitter user has helpfully suggested that Rogers should unplug their network, wait 30 seconds, and then plug it back in. After all, that's what they usually suggest to customers. Anyway, as of noon Eastern Time on Saturday, CBC is reporting that most of Rogers' services, have finally been restored. And it sounds like the authorities are gearing up to put executives in the hot seat, especially since this is Rogers' second network-wide failure in 15 months, and it makes the AT&T failure in the U.S. in 1990 look small. This is probably a good time to talk about the Rogers outage, especially since they probably can't hear me right now anyway. The Rogers outage points squarely at a pair of problems that the US and Canada have in common, and those are consolidation and lack of competition. The reason why the Rogers outage was so massively impactful is that it was because Rogers provides an enormous chunk of Canada's connectivity. They got this way by buying up other companies. I mean, hell, they're in the middle of trying to buy up Shaw Communications right now. The CRTC, Canada's counterpart to the FCC, has approved the purchase, but the Canadian Competition Bureau is trying to block it on the grounds that it will reduce competition in the wireless market. This all sounds very familiar. At least Canada still has four wireless options. We are down to three here in the U.S. Then there are landline services. Cable TV we can probably ignore since it's becoming less and less relevant these days. Same thing goes for landline telephone service, but the same infrastructure that delivers those two services these days is what delivers your internet to your home. In the vast majority of places in the U.S., the number of options that you have for internet service is one. One choice. If you're exceptionally lucky, you might live in a city like Schenectady that has more options. We have two on the east end of town, and there is rumored to be a third one on the west end of town. That's exceptionally rare. The lack of competition means that pricing can be whatever they want to charge. The company that holds the monopoly in areas around Schenectady charges $60 a month for basic service. Now, sure, you can get it discounted to $45 for the first year of service, but what are you going to do, go offline for a month at the end of the year just to get that price back? Meanwhile, the main competitor in competitive areas charges $40 for that basic level of service and delivers about 50% more bandwidth than they promise. Satellite internet is getting better. Starlink exists, shows some promise, but I don't believe it's hit its full potential yet. So, is just using mobile internet a competitive option? Maybe. Maybe. I think it's going to depend on where you are. Using 5G, I can clock an 85 megabit speed test in most of Schenectady. However, if I go one town over, I've actually clocked speed tests of 700 down and 100 up. That's impressive, and maybe viable as an alternative to wireline internet. I have to assume that the other two carriers have similar results, probably with similar patchiness. Maybe as 5G becomes more fully and widely deployed, this will improve. The elephant in the room with using wireless is data caps. With a fiber or a cable connection in most places, you don't need to worry about data caps because there either aren't any or they're insanely high. With mobile data, you can easily get unlimited data for you to use on your phone, but if you want to tether it and use it for something else, well, then you have limits after which it slows to a crawl or stops entirely. I understand that the wireless carriers have some home internet packages as well. I don't know much about them. I do know that the pricing is arranged to suit the use case, and I know some rural folks who are using this option. It does work, but it's kind of slow. So, there are three wireless providers. There used to be more. The most recent one to disappear was Sprint, who got swallowed up by T-Mobile. Over the years, I'd heard of attempts by other combinations to merge, like AT&T wanting to buy T-Mobile. I joked at the time that the merged company should be called AT&T, Verizon wanting to buy Sprint, etc., and it often got squashed because of concerns over a lack of competition. The problem with that is, whether or not there is stomach for the rampant elimination of competition seems to be a matter of political will. As such, we can't count on the market to stay diverse because that political will changes every 2 years. All right, so let's talk OPSEC for today. Could what happened in Canada yesterday happen in the U.S.? I made reference earlier in this podcast to the AT&T outage in 1990. Yes, that was 32 years ago. Yes, I'm sure that there were lessons learned and incorporated. But just back a couple of months ago in April, there was a localized outage of AT&T Wireless, and I mentioned it in episode 81. It wasn't a gonzo whopper like what happened to Rogers, but folks in area codes 518 and 838 had no wireless service, if they got it from AT&T, that is. It could have been any carrier, really. I don't want you to think that I'm picking on AT&T. This could just as easily have been Verizon or T-Mo. So I want you to keep a couple of things in mind. First, these systems are built by humans, and humans are fallible. We make mistakes. If we didn't make mistakes, I wouldn't have to occasionally issue corrections on this podcast, right? Right. Humans make mistakes. Second, businesses optimize for profit. Make of that what you will, but the bottom line is the bottom line. To improve the bottom line, you can either increase revenue or reduce costs. Reducing costs means consistently trying to get more and more out of the same resources, including your staff. This increases the likelihood of a mistake being made, and indeed, they do get made, and most of them are harmless or low impact. What happened to Rogers yesterday, and to AT&T 32 years ago, was the error that crept into someplace critical. So what can we do to protect ourselves? Well, I'm going to start by repeating a suggestion I made in episode 81, and that is to diversify your communications. If you are one of the rare folks like me who actually does still have a landline, get it from somebody other than whoever you get your cell service from. Same with your internet service. If there's multiple people in your house, get your cell service from different providers. But what else went wrong that we can protect against? Well, first, we would want to keep some cash on hand. The scenario is that payment networks, or something that they rely upon, can fail. And it's good just to have a backup. As it happens, I use payment cards for just about everything. I think most people do these days. But I do keep some cash on hand, enough to keep life moving forward if anything were to take out the payment networks for a few days. Second, we want to keep our vehicles fueled. That's simple enough. Just if you drive, when your tank gets down to about half, fill it. If we were to encounter a scenario like, for instance, the Colonial Pipeline incident last year, which resulted in hoarding incidents and gas stations running dry in parts of the country, you will have the ability still to get around. Third, if it's within your means to do so, keep your pantry well stocked. Don't wait until you run out of something before you get more, unless it's something highly perishable like milk. Things that you use that keep some on hand. At the very least, a few bricks of ramen can keep you going for a few days while the world is falling apart around you. And that's really the key here. Keep things stocked up where you can, and you can face these short-term problems calmly until they are solved. Since we started with the fail of the week, we're going to end this episode with the pwn of the week. This week's pwn is Marriott. Threat actors, it seems, were able to exfiltrate about 20 gigabytes of data from the hotel chain, including business documents, customer payment data, all tied to the Baltimore-Washington International Airport Marriott. The pwn is believed to affect around 300 to 400 customers, and it does include credit card authorizations, so the ability to perform a scam is there. The attackers got into the system by way of social engineering, in which they tricked an employee into giving them access. This did not gain any access to Marriott's core network. The attackers did attempt to ransom the hotel's data, however, they were not successful. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fongaboo and The Crowded Helix for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 group. Special thanks to Thriller at Play, Telegram Sam, Knight Rider 007, Azriel, Ed, and Joe Cadillac for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Week music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker. And our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast, or want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next week when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Stay safe and be well. Which resulted in hoarding incidents and gas station...